Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Congo crisis. With the upsurge of fighting in eastern Congo, we look at the prospects for peace and shine the spotlight on the worsening humanitarian situation for those displaced by the violence. Unknown heroes. As ceremonies are held to commemorate those who died in the two world wars, we find out more about little-known heroic figures who helped save many lives in Italy during the last war. And the Second Coming. Pope Benedict speaks about St. Paul's teaching on the Lord's Second Coming at his weekly general audience. Pope Benedict has deplored the deaths of civilians in fighting in eastern Congo and urged an end to the violence and systematic atrocities there.
Sanguinosi scontri armati e sistematiche atrocità.
Speaking at his Angelus address, the Pope said destruction, pillage and violence of every sort have forced tens of thousands more people to abandon what little they had to survive. I renew, he said, my fervent appeal for everyone to work together for peace in a land that has been martyrized for too long.
Da troppo tempo martoriata.
The Pope's appeal came as the United Nations is being urged to increase the number of peacekeepers in eastern Congo to protect civilians amid new fighting there and mounting deaths. A massive humanitarian crisis in eastern Congo exploded after the rebel leader Laurent Nkunda launched an offensive against government troops at the end of August. Tens of thousands of civilians were forced to flee their homes due to the upsurge in fighting, and many of them are packed into camps with little facilities. Others have fled into the forests and risked death from starvation. Aid agencies say the humanitarian crisis is of huge proportions, and it comes in a nation where the upheaval caused by war and conflict over the past two decades has indirectly led to the death of millions of people. Judith Melby is an expert on Congolese affairs who works for the charity Christian Aid. I began by asking her what chances there are of a political settlement to resolve the conflict in the eastern Congo.
I think when we're talking about the eastern Congo, a great big healthy dose of skepticism is always handy. I think this time, perhaps, the international community, and in particular the US and the UK, do understand that there is a terrific need for a political settlement. Now, that's a long road. It's going to take huge commitment. And more importantly, it's going to take commitment long after this story is on the news pages. So for the moment, I will remain very, very cautiously optimistic.
Now, the underlying cause, and this has been a cause that's been going on for decades in the Congo, is the illegal mining of minerals, as the country is enormously wealthy in that sense, with these natural resources. Now, this is going on apace. Who are the major players and how heavily involved are Western companies here?
Well, the UN panel of experts put out a report in 2002 listing the companies that were involved. There has been very little action since then. There are certainly a large number of Western companies involved, and now the latest phenomena we see is sort of the entrance of Chinese companies.
So what leverage, if any, can the international community put on General Laurent Nkunda and his rebel forces?
If I can I just say that there are really two major reasons for the fighting in eastern Congo. Certainly illegal mineral mining is key, but the other one are the tensions between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. Much of this stems from the genocide in 94, the arrival of the troops of Laurent Kabila in 96, when then a great number of Hutu genocidaires fled further into eastern Congo. Many of these militias are still in eastern Congo, and that is where we have the role of Rwanda, which justifiably fears attacks by these remaining militias in eastern Congo.
Right, turning now to the humanitarian situation, can you briefly paint me a brief picture of what the current situation is like there?
The current situation is really just a really exaggerated and far more acute situation of what's been going on in eastern Congo for months and for years. Always, Congo is one of these forgotten crises. When you're looking at the displaced people in the east, you're not talking about people who've been displaced once. They've been displaced twice, three times, four times, five times. And the fighting has gone back and forth amongst the various militias in the eastern Congo, along with the Congolese army. It is absolutely disastrous. And when you're talking about people who have been displaced, for instance, up to five times, they have absolutely nothing to fall back on. So these are people who are desperate for all kinds of aid, whether you're talking food, water, shelter, clothes, and most importantly, security. We have a massive problem of protection of civilians in eastern Congo.
But do we have any figures on how many people have been uprooted in this latest round of fighting? I was reading somewhere that they were saying that about a million were displaced.
I think you've got well over a million displaced, but you've got about, you know, another 50,000 who've been displaced just in the last couple of weeks. And, you know, really, when you're talking about eastern Congo, numbers become an irrelevance. We're talking about the population in eastern Congo. This is a huge, huge problem. And we've seen over the last weeks that in spite of the fact that there has been a ceasefire, we've seen evidence and footage of villages which again are being emptied, which again children are being taken to act both as child soldiers, sex slaves, porters. So this is going on as we speak.
And how short of food is the civilian population there? What kind of feedback are you getting from the humanitarian organisations like yourself that are on the ground there?
I don't think it's that much a shortage of humanitarian supplies. It is the inability to reach these people. Many times humanitarian agencies have reached a village, they found it completely empty. People have fled into the forest. This is one of the biggest problems facing humanitarian agencies, is finding the people who need help. Because unless we know exactly how many people we're talking about and what their needs, it's very difficult for us to act. And constantly we're running up against the situation of looking for a population and discovering that, you know, the night before they fled.
You talked about the insecurity there. Are there many, many cases of women being raped, too frightened to go out, say, from the camps, too frightened to leave the forest because they're likely to be attacked?
Rape has been used as a weapon of war in eastern Congo for years and years and years. I think it's a sad fact that the first time I wrote a report on rape as a weapon of war was 5 years ago. It has become normal. It is... Someone said to me when I was researching the report, it is the normalization of violence. It is a huge problem in eastern Congo, and it is going on as we speak.
Now, when you talk to people there in Congo, what kind of feedback do they give you about the mood of the people that at least they've been able to reach and who they are caring for in the camps?
They are desperately, desperately tired of being on the run and being in a war situation. I mean, put yourself in their place. Suppose you had been forced to leave your home time and time again, always caught in crossfire, always on the run, always on the road, never sure of protection, of security, of food. This is a population that is completely exhausted and quite frankly is wondering, why on earth are they always the innocent victims of this?
Now, what about the situation specifically in Goma? What kind of reports are you getting from there?
Goma again has been a focal point for the refugees. Goma has close to 100,000 refugees. The city has very little infrastructure. You have to keep in mind that Eastern Congo is already, even without war, desperately poor. There is very little infrastructure to house, feed all of these people. Some of them are staying in what's known as host families, say members of extended families or friends that they know. But a great many of them are just camped out in schools, in clinics, in football fields, seeking safety.
And if the fighting doesn't end, you said that Congo has had an ongoing humanitarian emergency for years, if not decades. If the fighting doesn't end, are we staring in the face of a really major humanitarian catastrophe there, the situation precipitating to a dramatic degree?
If the fighting goes on, an interesting question. I think if the fighting goes on and covers an even greater area, affects an even greater number of people, we have a lot of questions to ask ourselves, because we really do have a responsibility to step in there and ensure that it does not become a greater problem, to ensure that we do finally find a political solution to this problem, because more fighting is not the solution. There is no military solution to the problem in Eastern Congo. There can only be a political solution.
And when it comes to help from the West in terms of aid, are you finding that the population is responding to your appeals for help?
Oh, hugely. We have an appeal at the moment for Eastern Congo, and certainly in the UK, the British population is responding enormously generously. I think, you know, sometimes the ordinary people understand the situation better than the politicians, and certainly, you know, a response to the needs of the people in Eastern Congo is not our problem. People out there do understand that their brothers and sisters in Eastern Congo need help.
I was talking there to Judith Melby from the charity Christian Aid. This week, ceremonies were held across the globe to mark the 90th anniversary of the end of World War I. It's a time when we commemorate those who died for their country, in both the First and Second World Wars and in all subsequent conflicts. Here in Italy, the Second World War is inevitably associated with the human evil of Nazism and fascism, and the killings and brutality that are part and parcel of any armed conflict. But in the midst of this grim and bloody period in history, there were many inspirational examples of human solidarity carried out by little-known heroic figures, people who helped save many lives through their generosity and bravery, but whose actions never made the world headlines. Let's hear about one of them now. Captain Derek Miller was a young doctor serving with the British Army during the Second World War. Taken prisoner in 1941, he was sent to a prisoner of war camp in Servigliano in the Marche region of Italy. Here he was one of two medics responsible for the health of the 2,000 men detained there. After the armistice was signed by Italy in 1943, he managed to convince the Italian commander of the camp to let the prisoners escape before the German troops arrived and deported them to Germany. He took sole responsibility for this decision against the judgment of the camp commander and against a stay-put order from his superiors ordering all Allied prisoners to remain in the camps. His courageous act of disobedience allowed around 2,000 prisoners to escape and seek safety, unlike the prisoners detained in other camps nearby who remained where they were and ended up being deported to Germany. These escaped prisoners fled into the surrounding countryside and found refuge among the local peasant population, who gave them shelter, food, lodging and protection. The local Italians did this at great risk to their own safety, because if they had been caught harbouring an Allied soldier, they would have been killed by the occupying German troops. And despite their own poverty and lack of food, they shared what little they had with the fugitive Allied troops. Dr. Lois Sproat is the daughter of Derek Miller and was in Rome recently for a presentation at the British Embassy of her father's memoirs. I began by asking her for more details about how her father organised the escape of the Allied prisoners from the camp in Italy where they were all interned.
Yes, he was aware that they were supposedly going to be guarded by the few guards in the Italian camp against the Germans, who they knew were, I think, going to get there before any Allied forces could. And he felt, I think, this was obviously untenable, and the only route was for them to have a chance to escape and look after themselves.
What, in your view, are some of the most moving or poignant incidents recounted in his memoirs?
I think some of the most... He always never described himself being a brave man, so I think he found the actual being a prisoner very difficult. And the escape... Well, actually, one of the amusing ones, really, is in San Benedetto, when he went to try and find this boat. And he described to me, I remember, wandering around this town, around the dock, trying to speak to somebody who could help him to find a boat. And suddenly was very aware the curfew was coming. And he does describe in the memoirs about hearing an English word being spoken and just spoke to this person, who luckily turned out to be an American who'd got caught up in the war when he'd been visiting in 1940 and had to stay. And then, of course, commandeering some poor Italian boy to actually drive the boat, because none of them knew how to work an engine, and my father steered it. But he was terrified of water and hated sailing. It wasn't something he took naturally to.
Now, one of the most amazing and moving aspects of this whole experience is the fact that these Italian agricultural workers, people from the land in the rural areas, risk their lives to take in these escaped prisoners, not even sharing their language, and they were already short of food themselves. What do you think this says about people, about human nature in times of adversity?
It's almost beyond words, isn't it? It's just shows, I guess, that when people... humans see other humans in extreme situations, they do act in extremely heroic and generous ways that are beyond words, really.
What did your father have to say about the generosity and the sacrifices that the local population in central Italy, in the Marche, took? I mean, what were his comments about them?
He was equally, I think, just terribly grateful to these poor. He's very aware they were very poor people who had very little material things to offer, and was also very aware how brave they were being.
Did he keep in touch with these people after the war? What kind of relationship or friendship did he manage to maintain with some of them?
The only one he really, I'm aware of, was this man, Lino Papiri, who he did meet some years later again, and he did talk very fondly of him and his family. I think he spent quite a bit of time with him.
The memoirs of Captain Miller have just been published by the Monte San Martino Trust, named after the saint of the same name, who, according to legend, cut his cloak in two in order to share it with a beggar who risked dying from the cold. This trust was set up in 1989 as a permanent tribute to the Italian people, who extended a helping hand to the escaping Allied prisoners of war following the armistice in 1943. It helps raise funds to give bursaries to young Italian students to go to England to study the language. About a third of those students have relatives who helped escaping prisoners of war. Professor Ruggiero Ranieri is the publisher of another book on this same subject, entitled Allied Prisoners, Capture, Detention and Escape in the Marche Region in 1941 to 1944. Renier told me why he believes this little-known chapter in the history of Italy during the Second World War deserves greater attention because of the many examples of generosity and courage among the Italian country folk or contadini.
Well, there were a number of episodes of heroic behaviour on the part of local contadini, on the part of the prisoners themselves, on the part of the helpers, i.e. people who organised to help the rescue operations. So a number of interesting things happened. It would be very long to mention them. Lots of people were killed in this kind of network, in this resistance network. I think this whole saga, this whole area needs to be recognised for what it was, an important element of this civil resistance, whereby Italian civilians, Allied prisoners, came together to try and provide some kind of alternative, some kind of way out from the fascist and Nazi domination. So I think this is an important part of the story of the Second World War. It hasn't received the attention and the recognition that it probably deserves.
What kind of moral do you think it shows us? You know, as you say, war is so much associated with brutality, with killings, with rape, with pillage, all sorts of horrendous crimes which are committed during war. Yet at the same time, alongside this, and very often, as you say, not being spoken about, there's these amazing acts of heroism.
Well, I think it has to do with a basic sense of humanity, of justice, which at one point during the war, I think around 1943, you know, after 1943, began to emerge amongst the ordinary civilians, amongst the population, amongst the contadini. Why? Because they probably felt, you know, they probably understood at that point that it was a war in which there were clearly some moral distinctions to be made, the good and the evil. I think at that point this came out, this emerged, and this is why they were prepared to help their, inverted commas, enemies, or their former enemies, because they recognized that this was the right thing to do at that time. There had been quite a lot of German brutality. People understood by that time what the real issues were, and I think this is what explains this widespread sentiment in certain areas of Italy. It's not that the Italians were never fascist or that they never supported the regime. I think this would be wrong. They did support fascism. Vast numbers of them did.
But the scales were beginning to drop from their eyes and they saw the truth.
I think they began to see this quite clearly. It began, perhaps not rationally. Most of these people were more or less uneducated.
Do you think somehow that religion could have played a part? Perhaps some of them devout Catholics and they felt there was a need to act like the Good Samaritan?
Possibly this played a part. Not surprising, some of these areas were very religious. The Marche is a very Catholic part of the country. So this might have played a part, but I would take it one step further and talk about decent human values, that were probably part of the fabric of the Italian population, of Italian life, below and beyond political regimes. This was a basic characteristic that ever emerged at one point as being important in what people chose to do.
Human solidarity.
Roger Abson, who is the major historian of this episode, he wrote a book called A Strange Alliance, in which he said, here are people coming together from different parts of the woods. I mean, allies with the contadini. What is it that binds them together? And basically his answer is along the lines that I've been trying to convey, that these people were driven by a sense of common solidarity, the search for some common human values, justice, freedom.
And the need to resist the evil?
Resist the evil, exactly. Resist the evil, resist brutality, and find a common theme for the future, trying to believe in humanity again. So I think this is why this episode is so worth researching and telling to the younger generations.
That was Professor Ranieri, Italian book publisher. And you earlier heard the voice of Lois Sproat, daughter of the World War II doctor and hero, Derek Miller. Thank you. St. Paul's teaching on the Lord's second coming was the focus of Pope Benedict's catechesis at his weekly general audience. Emma McCarthy reports. Pilgrims in St. Peter's Square wrapped themselves warm against the November chill this Wednesday as they greeted Pope Benedict and prepared to hear the latest installment in his lessons on St. Paul. This, the ninth in the series, was the second to focus on the saint's proclamation of Christ's death and resurrection before moving on to the saint's teaching on the Lord's second coming.
For Paul, the Lord's return at the end of time will be accompanied by the resurrection of the dead and the consummation of his kingdom, when all those who believed in him and trusted in his promises will be with him forever in glory. Christ's victorious reign has in fact already begun. Yet we who have received the Spirit as the first fruits of our redemption patiently await the fulfillment of that plan in our lives.
Pope Benedict told pilgrims, without Christ's presence, we will never really have a truly just and renewed world.
Our life in this world, marked by trials and tribulations, must be inspired by the hope of heaven and the expectation of our resurrection to glory. Paul's rich eschatology linking the already of Christ's resurrection to the not yet of our life in this world is reflected in his statement that in hope we were saved. This same joyful expectation of the Lord's return and the fulfillment of the Father's saving plan is seen in the ancient Christian prayer with which he concludes his first letter to the Corinthians. Maranatha, come Lord Jesus.
Concluding, Pope Benedict remarked, "We do not want the end of the world, but we want the end of an unjust world. We want that this world change profoundly, that a civilization of love begin, for a world of justice and peace, free of violence and fear." "How can this happen," asked Pope Benedict, "without Christ?"
I offer a warm welcome to all English-speaking visitors present to this audience, particularly priests from the Missionary Society of St. Paul the Apostle, members of the Corpus Christi Movement for Priests, participants in the International Catholic Conference of Scouting, and pilgrims from the Philippines, England, Nigeria, and the United States of America. Upon you and your families, I cordially invoke God's blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Emma McCarthy. That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so do send us an email. Laudato Jesus Christus.